here's something of what we know about Norman Mailer. In his biography, he's described as one of the giants of American letters and one of the most celebrated figures of his time. He was a novelist, journalist, biographer, and filmmaker, a provocateur and passionate observer of his times. The National Book Foundation tells us that Mailer is considered an innovator of creative nonfiction, a genre sometimes called new journalism. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize 2 times and the National Book Award once. In 2005, Mailer received the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters from the National Book Foundation. Mailer was born on January 31st, this day, 1923, in Monmouth Memorial Hospital in New Jersey. He went on to write prolifically and would contribute to and help shape the national conversation for over 60 years. He died on November 10th, 2007. J. Michael Lennon is Emeritus Professor of English at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, a longtime associate of Norman Mailer's and Mailer's archivist and Mailer scholar. Before his death, Mailer asked Dr. Lennon to take over writing his authorized biography. And the 945-page volume, Norman Mailer, A Double Life, was published by Simon & Schuster to great acclaim. In Chapter 10 of the biography, Dr. Lennon tells the story of Mailer's 50th birthday party in 1973 in New York City. The event was to be held at the Four Seasons on Park Avenue. Mailer promised to make an announcement of national importance. Close to 600 people attended, including Senator Jacob and Marion Javits and Senator Eugene McCarthy. Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine, and Rod Steiger were part of the Hollywood contingent. Larry L. King, Larry McMurtry, and Jessica Mitford were three of the many writers. Dodson Rader came with Princess Diane von Furstenberg. Elaine Kaufman, owner of Elaine's, was there. George Plimpton, Andy Warhol, and cabaret singer Bobby Short. The major gossip columnists and reporters showed up, grudgingly in some cases. Dorothy Schiff, owner of the New York Post, came, but Gloria Steinem did not. The Mailer family was represented by his mother, Fan, and sister Barbara, Mailer's 4 eldest daughters, ex-wives, Jean and Adele, and current partner, Carol. His assistant, Suzanne Nye, was at his side during the evening. Everyone drank and nibbled for close to 2 hours. The Village Voice reporter watched the swirling crowd. At its center was sure to be Norman Mailer in the flesh, feet wide planted, drink in hand, finger jabbing chests and the air, sterling silver Brillo pad hair bobbing up and down to the rhythm of the crowd he'd drawn. At midnight, Jimmy Breslin introduced Mailer as one of the half-dozen original thinkers of this century. Mailer began with a dirty joke, but he began to lose the audience. He maundered. Finally, though, the announcement. The Fifth Estate would be a people's organization to track and publish the activities of the FBI and the CIA in the wake of the emerging Watergate scandal, the burglary of the Democratic National Headquarters in Washington the previous June. There were some shouted questions in catcalls as he warned of the nation's drift toward totalitarianism, but the crowd was ebbing away. The next day, at a press conference at the Algonquin, it was packed with TV cameras and reporters. What he was really proposing, Mailer explained, was an organization like the American Civil Liberties Union. He wanted it to be staffed by the best literary, scholarly, and detective minds and serve as a kind of national ombudsman in a morally dastardly country, one that should take a long, hard look at the events of the recent past to determine if government conspiracies existed. As Mailer goes, so goes the nation. That's the form his genius takes, according to Wilfred Sheed. But after the embarrassing failure of the birthday party, and despite his sober and reasoned explanation of the Fifth Estate idea the next day, it seemed as if he had lost his bellwether status. However, on February 7th, the day after Mailer's press conference, the Senate voted to create the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, chaired by Sam Ervin, a Democrat from North Carolina, and co-chaired by Howard Baker, Republican of Tennessee, to investigate the Watergate burglary. This action was prompted in large part by the reporting in the Washington Post of Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. On the same day, some of President Nixon's officials met to cover up the forthcoming investigation, as later revealed by White House counsel John Dean. By the third week in April, Dean and Attorney General John Mitchell were implicated in the cover-up, and slowly but thoroughly, the cover-up was exposed. As all these events unfolded, Mailer's warnings were suddenly re-evaluated. An abridged account of Norman Mailer's 50th birthday from J. Michael Lennon's biography titled Norman Mailer, A Double Life, describing an outward-facing Norman Mailer.
There.
Mailer as public figure and provocateur. Today, on January 31st, the 102nd anniversary of Mailer's birth, we speak with Dr. Lennon about an especially inward-turning time in Mailer's life, when he began to write a journal, Lipton's Journal, as he called it, in which, as Lennon tells us, he looks at his childhood, his wives, his family and friends, his ambitions and his failures, his writings, all with an eye to clarifying the basic lineaments and conflicts of his psyche so that he can move forward and claim his genius. As it happened on his 32nd birthday, Mailer wrote over 1,000 words in the journal, a record. We had a chance to speak by phone with Dr. Lennon about the recent release titled Lipton's, Mailer's Marijuana Journal, 1954-55, co-edited by J.R. Lucas and Susan Mailer, and its significance in telling the story of Mailer's life.
It came in a moment of truth, you might say, in Mailer's life. Imagine that only 6 years before, he had written a massive bestseller about World War II in the Pacific called The Naked and the Dead, still widely considered to be the best book about Americans at war in the Pacific in World War II. He had written that book. It was an enormous success. He went from total obscurity to becoming roughly, you know, really well-known. And then his next two books were bombs. Bob Reshore, and I won't get into them, but they're interesting books. They're wonderful books. Bob Reshore didn't do very well at all. It was called Tasteless, Tasteless, and Graceless. Mailer wrote a third novel about Hollywood called The Deer Park. And when he started at the Journal, he thought that The Deer Park was about to be published. But at the last minute, with advertisements out there in Publishers Weekly and magazines and newspapers, the publisher at Reinhardt, Stanley Reinhardt, pulled the plug, canceled the contract. We're not publishing it because it's obscene. And, of course, the descriptions in it are so tame compared to what you can read today anywhere at any bookstore in any book about a sexual encounter. It's really pretty distant and opaque. But that was enough in 1954 for Stanley Reinhardt to pull the plug. So he pulled the plug, and Mailer just decided, well, you know, I've got to decide where I'm going to go. What am I going to write next? And he said, I'm going to start a journal. I want to write about the effects of marijuana, but I want to use the marijuana as a way of getting inside myself, opening myself up. He saw himself as a tin can, and marijuana was going to be the can opener that's going to open him up to all of his ideas and feelings and ambitions. And then shortly after he started writing the journal in December of 54, just a couple of months after that, I guess maybe 6 weeks after that, Stanley Reinhardt pulled the plug. So now he doesn't have a contract. The book is banned. He sent the book out to 6 different publishers, all turned it down. They were afraid. This is the middle of the 1950s, and, you know, you couldn't really write very openly about matters like sex in novels without being banned. And he wasn't banned by the public. He was banned by the publishing industry. They were all afraid of him. So he started the journal, and he said, that's it. I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to just write and write and write, and I'm going to write whatever comes into my mind. But the big thing I want to do is I want to understand what are my assets, what are my talents, and how can I use them to make America a more exciting, a more dynamic country, a country that isn't afraid, a country that is willing to change, that is open to change, and isn't stuck. And so that's how he began. And he began it. And over the course of from December 54 to March 55, 4 month period, he wrote 104,000 words, writing every 4, 5, 6 days. I think there's 21 different days that he wrote. And when he wrote, he would write, you know, 3, 4, 5,000 words every time. And he just let it rip. He just sat at the typewriter and let it rip. He didn't revise. He didn't change. If he revised, if he wrote an entry, then the next entry might be a revision of the one before. So it's a cluttered document, a really difficult document, never meant for publication. It was never meant. And he says it right in here. This could never be published. Not only because it was messy, but because he was frank. And so that was the situation he was in. He was really doing a stock-taking, looking at himself, looking at all of his assets, all of his problems, all of his fears, all of his hopes, and trying to be courageous and not lying to himself, talking about all of his weaknesses as well as his strengths.
And Mike, you would know so well the concept of doubleness from your biography of Mailer, The Double Life. And there are so many occasions in Lipton's when we get these oppositions, and there's that segment where he looks in the mirror or describes looking in the mirror, left side, right side. Talk to us a little bit about how that would be a revelation for him in this journal of who he is.
Well, Mailer really saw himself as a divided person, and he saw the country as a divided country, and he saw all of us a battle between two sides of our personality. The American psyche was divided into half. And so when he looked in the mirror and himself in that passage you're talking about, he said, on one side, I see the timid, nice boy from Brooklyn who is polite, who is kind, who wears a coat, says yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, and so on. And on the other side, I see a different side to my face. And it is that of a rebel who questions things, who wonders, why can't we be better? Who does not accept the given, who is opposed to kind of the fog of conformity that was laying over American life in the 1950s like a wet blanket. And so he conceived in the document, in the journal, Lipton's, in the 600 separate entries that he wrote over that four-month period, that there were two forces in American life. And one was encouraging conformity, getting along by going along and getting along. And the other was to question everything, to ask, why are we doing this? Why are there so many? Why are books being banned? Why can't people smoke marijuana? Why are gay relationships forbidden? All of the issues that were just nobody wanted to talk about in the 1950s. There was a blanket over things. Everything was smothered, and he decided he was going to, those two forces, he called one sociostatic, that was the forces of conformity that were making people afraid to change, and the other was homeodynamism. He made these terms up. That was rebel. So it was basically rebellion versus conformity, and he didn't think that they were necessarily, one was all good and one was all bad. He saw that there was something to be said for certain kinds of conformity, for certain kinds of belief in tradition, conservation of energy, conservation of the country, of the good things in the country. So it wasn't a simple black and white opposition. It was more like one of those Venn diagrams that overlap each other, or yang and yin, interpenetrating each other. But there were definitely extremes, and he was on the side much more of change than he was stasis.
In the course of the writing of the journal, in sharing with the person who became his friend and confidant, Robert Lindner, didn't Mailer say, why am I the one who's doing this when my character would say my temperament shouldn't predispose me to be responsible for this? And why is Robert doing this when his temperament should predispose him to do something else? Talk to us a little bit about the key friendship and the bond and what that did in helping this journal keep going until it came to its close.
One of the contexts for understanding the journal is the whole psychoanalysis revolution that was going on. I mean, Freud was only dead for, you know, 10, 15 years at this time. But psychoanalysis was a wave that was running all over Europe and the United States, and it had been since the end of the Second World War. how do we understand what happened in the Holocaust? How do we understand the German character? How do we understand all the hidden fears that are in life? We need Freud. And so the Freudian Revolution came to the United States, and Linder was an MD. He was a doctor. He was a psychologist. And he was very well read in all of these writers. Freud, Jung, Adler, Horney, all the great psychoanalytic writers. And Mailer was too. If you look at the index of the book, virtually there's like 20 different famous writers on Freudian psychology, half of whom are forgotten today. Mailer knew them all. And New York City was the center for psychoanalysis. It still is. It still is. I mean, it used to say that half the people in New York City were either in analysis or just came out of it. And it's true. So that's part of it. And Linder wrote a book called Must You Conform? It was published by Mailer's publisher. Mailer got a copy of it, and he read it. And Linder was saying, you know, analysis shouldn't be about making you conform, making you fit in. It should be encouraging you to ask questions and put your pin into the balloons of conformity and getting along. You know, he said that's wrong. Freud didn't intend that. And so he's a critique of the way psychoanalysis was being done, which was telling you, you got to button up your tie and your coat and settle down and stop complaining and get along with people. No, he said, that's the wrong thing. Psychoanalysis should turn you into a rebel. And he wrote another book called A Rebel Without a Cause. And, of course, that was a famous movie made with James Dean, still well known, except they just bought the book because they wanted the title. And they didn't use anything in his book. They just used it, and then they tacked it onto a movie about James Dean. But it was the same thing. Mailer read his book, and he said, you know, I agree with you completely. You're right. That's what we should be doing. We should be rebelling. We should not be conforming. But you don't say what we're rebelling against. What is wrong with American society? You've only done half the job. You're saying get out there and rebel, but you didn't tell us what it is. What's wrong with society? You lost your nerve. And so that opened up a discussion. And Mailer learned from Linder, and Linder learned from Mailer. You know, they educated each other. Mailer would write 20 pages, and he'd mail them to Linder. Linder would write up a set of remarks and send it back, and Norman would incorporate some of his ideas. So really, Lipton's is written by two people. Mailer's the major author, but Linder is a secondary author. And then they wrote 20, 30 letters to each other, which are included, most of them, all the important ones, at the end of the book, because they are sort of a meta-commentary on those letters, and they were written really basically at the same time, as you can see when you look at the dates. So the discovery of all of those letters, we had some of them, but we didn't have them all. My wife Donna tracked down and found Linder's daughter, Margaret, who happens to be a psychoanalyst, and then put her in touch with Susan Mailer, Mailer's oldest daughter, who was the co-editor of this book, and they hit it off. And we got permission to publish them all. So it adds like an extra chapter at the end of the book that is the commentary of somebody who's read all the stuff in it and has said, Mailer, you're wrong here. You're smoking too much marijuana. They had a big fight about that. Linder thought marijuana was just going to put you in la-la land. Mailer said, no, it opened you up. They never came to an agreement on it. And then tragically, just when Mailer had finished writing the journal, Linder died of congestive heart disease at the age of 41. In 1956, and Mailer eulogized him in the Village Voice. So it's the story of that friendship is there. He's mentioned in Lipton's in various entries, and then at the end you get them talking back to each other.
We'll get to how it came that you all got this out into the public, but I just wanted to ask a couple more things about Lipton's, and that was the idea of Mailer's trying to find his voice, saying he was writing in a heavy way, philosophical way, but he was beginning through this to get a sense of the sound of his writing and more of the stylistic aspect of what it means to be a writer and a novelist.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's very important. Mailer thought of himself as a novelist of ideas when he began. He understood you had to tell a story, you had to create character and so forth. But he was always trying to lever big ideas into his novels. The novel should be telling you, explaining life to you, helping you learn how to live. It should be a pattern or a formula for life. And as he went on, he realized that the work of being a creative writer, a novelist, also meant that you had to pay a lot of attention to your sentences. That's all we really create as writer is sentences. And he began to realize that he needed a style that was not just like a railroad car carrying chunks of information along. He needed a style that was going to be in communion with his own spirit, with his own sense of self. It's going to capture his personality. He wanted a style like that. And it was kind of an edgy, angry, comic, self-reflective style. And this is where he invented. This is when Norman Mailer becomes Norman Mailer, the writer. Because after this, all of his writing carries the same kind of verve and energy and wit that he didn't have in his second and third novels. He didn't have a great story in his second and third novels like he did in The Naked and the Dead, and that carried the day. And so he invented himself as a different kind of writer with a much more dynamic and engaging style. And, you know, it's impossible to really describe it, you know, but if you read what Mailer wrote in 1951 and you read what he wrote in Advertisements for Myself, or really when he helped invent the Village Voice as a newspaper, the first kind of underground newspaper in America in 1955-56, comes right after Lipton's. All the way he writes in there as kind of an angry, funny columnist is a reflection of what he did in Lipton. And then he went on from there. I'm not saying his style didn't change or develop over time. It certainly did. But this is where the essential Mailer style was created in Lipton's. And so that's another reason for enjoying it. You can see as he goes through, he gets better. His style gets more interesting, gets more lively, gets funnier, more self-reflective. We're watching his mind grow and his sense of linguistic athleticism becoming more profound as he goes along.
Would he have attributed that in part to smoking marijuana?
Yes, he was. He was always clear that he was kind of a stodgy person until he had marijuana and it changed his life. That it made him, it just opened him up. He said, it opened me up. I felt alive. I felt like the things I was doing were genuine. I wasn't always watching myself, you know, afraid to open up, afraid to talk. He said, it made me more fluent. It opened up the river of ideas inside me, the river of style. And it became, you know, and obviously many people have had that kind of experience with marijuana. Other people, it just puts them to sleep. It's not the same with everyone at all. But for him, it worked. Lindner was much more buttoned down, much more afraid of it. He tried it, but he didn't like it. He was afraid of it. And Mailer was just the opposite. And that really caused a breakup that they had at the end of Lindner's life. Was fighting about marijuana, and he was saying, Norman, you're drinking too much, you're smoking too much marijuana, it's bad for you. After all, he was a doctor, and he knew it was bad for him, and ultimately, Mailer saw that Lindner was right, and he knew, I've got to give up this stuff. And after he finished Lipton's, he cut back on his drinking. He was taking Benny's Benzedrine, which is kind of an upper. He was taking sleeping pills at night. He was drinking pots of coffee, smoking two packs of cigarettes. He was filling his body up with a lot of stuff, and ultimately he realized, if I'm going to be a writer, I can't have my head occluded by all these drugs, and he gave them up.
Mike, as his biographer, to what degree did Lipton's play a role in your coming to terms with Mailer as you were creating the biography?
It had a lot to do with it. I felt that I had a secret document that no one else had, a secret tool, and very few people had read it. It's a very forbidding document. It existed on really cheap paper typed by Mailer with a million typos and mistakes in it. It was very forbidding. It's, you know, it's like 300 pages of double-spaced prose. And so I read it. I thought about it. I studied it. A few other people knew about it, like Susan Mailer and Jerry Lucas, who, you know, co-edited it with me. But it really was, to me, the secret document to Norman Mailer's inside thoughts and ideas. And it's the pivot, sort of Norman Mailer before Lipton's and Norman Mailer after Lipton's. It's a dividing line in his life. And the river of his life divides at Lipton's to before and after. And so it was a critical document for me because I could see his style growing. I could see his ideas maturing. I could see him throwing away certain old ideas, picking up new ones, and dealing all the time with the shadow of Freud and Marx. And they are kind of the the twin figures behind the whole thing, Marx calling for a revolution in the economic nature of man, and Freud calling for a different kind of revolution of understanding the buried self. And so both of those were instrumental. You know, in one way, Lipton's is a treatise on the writings of Marx and Freud.
And didn't we read that Mailer said Lindner could be Engels and Marx and who's who, right?
Yeah, Norman needed acolytes. Norman needed acolytes all the time. He needed people who were going to buck him up, challenge him a little, listen to his ideas. You know, I mean, most writers need confidants. And you used that word right at the very beginning, and it's a well-chosen word. Lindner was a confidant, and he was not the only one Mailer had. Mailer had him before, and he had him later. But Lindner was a critical one because this was a critical juncture in Mailer's life. And you know, when he gets getting close to the end of Lipton's, he finally gets a contract for the Deer Park. He finally gets it. He quits drinking. He quits smoking marijuana so much. Goes to Provincetown, rewrites the book. And you can see that the revision of the Deer Park is much livelier and much more profound than the original version that he wrote before he was smoking marijuana.
You worked with Susan on the book, and she talked about Lindner and her father when we were talking about the memoir. Do you have any sense, does she speak to the public about what it has meant for her to have Lipton's come out and be published?
Well, you know, Susan said, I understand my father so much better reading Lipton's. And Susan, of course, is trained in psychoanalysis and is a psychoanalyst in Chile, and so she is familiar with all of this stuff. She understood it. She was a great guide and help in understanding this stuff. And it was helpful to her because she was born in 1949 and born at the same time that, you know, Mailer was out. She was born in Hollywood. And while she was out there, Mailer was still wrestling with trying to write about Hollywood and become a Hollywood figure. And so she was really seeing, she was like 4 or 5 years old. She's kind of a character in there. She's his only child at this point. And he talks about her all the time, his great feeling for her, how she entered his life in 1949, you know, 4 years, 5 years before he started writing this. So she's a little girl. And he's very, very close to her. He loves her dearly. So she becomes a figure because he understands his fatherhood. In many ways, this book is a reflection on his marriage to Adele and to his being a father to Lindner. Also, he talks about his parents, his mother, and his father especially, who was also a rebel. And Mailer discovers that and understands it much more and loves his father for encouraging the rebel in him. So he looks at his family very much in this, and Susan is very much a part of it. So she was very good. She brought another dimension into interpreting it. She saw some of the things he was doing, and I kind of poo-pooed certain things that he did, writing about language and writing about babies and things like that in the book. And she said, no, you know, we should keep some of those in there. He's looking for the deeper self of what is hidden in language. There's an awful lot of reflections on sounds of language, on words, on their meaning, the double meaning of all words and all language and all communication. And Susan was very good at pointing a lot of that out. So this book took 9 years to put together. It took a long, long time, and it's been cut by 40,000 words because of the repetitions, the huge problems in interpreting it, editing it, renumbering it. And, you know, Susan and Jerry really were, I could never have done this alone. I gave it up. I started it, I gave it up. And Susan came aboard, and then Jerry came aboard, and they were there becoming full collaborators on the thing that we got the thing done. I didn't think it would ever get published. It was a real labor of love.
And we have yet to touch on a documentary that has emerged as well. Could you give us a little sense of what that is?
Yes, I can. This the best documentary, I think, ever made on Norman Mailer. There's been 6 or 7 of them, and I've been involved with most of them. But this one was really a much more profound and dedicated piece of work. A guy named Jeff Zimbalist, who is the nephew of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., who you may remember. He used to be on the FBI, and he was an actor back in the 60s. Jeff is a director. He's made a number of documentary films. And he assembled a team of about six people. And I was a consultant on it, and John Buffalo Mailer was, and all of Mailer's children were interviewed for it. And it's a really deep dive into Mailer's life. He takes a lot of hits in it. We see him, warts and all. And it's divided into different chapters of his life about how to live an authentic life. And into six different chapters, you know. But I can say that it's the best documentary ever made, and it's got a cast of about 20 different people interviewing him. It's got a lot of footage, TV footage, movie footage, and audio footage that has never been heard before. They really put their nets down and looked and dug up all kinds of stuff. So it's a very lively, and Norman doesn't come across, he comes across as a flawed human being, a genius who had a lot of warts on him and flaws. And so it's an honest documentary. Mailer told me when I was writing the documentary to put everything in, he said, if you try to make me look like a saint, no one will read your book. They're not going to believe it. They know me too well. They know what a jerk I can be. And so you got to put it all in there. And this does it. It's not a literary analysis so much as the public Norman Mailer. It does talk about his books. It does talk about a lot of them. But you can't do a literary analysis in 104 minutes. You know, you can touch on it. And they do touch on some of the books, like The Naked and the Dead and The Executioner's Song, Armies of the Night, those three, more than all the others. Some of the books just get mentioned. But it does go through all the rough times of his life. That's when he stabbed his second wife, Susan's stepmother, Adele Mailer, with a penknife, and then nearly killed her. With his arrest at the March in the Pentagon, with his fights with feminists, all the things Mailer tried at, and a lot of them were failures. The movies that he made that didn't go anywhere, the movies that he made that did go somewhere, the books that worked, the books that didn't work. I mean, he lived a pretty full life, and he made a hell of a lot of mistakes, but he had an awful lot of victories.
And tell us the title and why they chose it.
It's called How to Come Alive with Norman Mailer. And he said at one point in a quote in the movie, he said, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to live. I want to come alive. I don't want to live a deadened life. I want to be as alive as I can. I've only got a certain span of time in this earth, and I want to use it. I want to be the most alive I can be. And he had things like, you know, that if you're not growing, you're dying. You've got to grow all the time. And if you don't grow, if you're not looking for growth, then that means that you're diminishing. And so that was one of the things that he said about himself, that you should be braver than you ought to be, pretend that you're braver than you ought to be, and you'll become braver. And so each sections, in six sections of the film, there's a quote from him, or sometimes it's from one of his family members or a friend about something about him that he followed. And then there are examples of it, of what happened in the different episodes of his life, all done with terrific film work in color, and in black and white, and in audio. Great montages of photographs, him at all these favorite events, including Chicago in 1968. That's also in there. Miami, the Siege of Chicago is dealt with as well. So it's a remarkable documentary. It's like 405 minutes, and it's gotten great reviews in New York Times, Variety, The Atlantic, Arts Fuse, and eventually it'll be streaming.
And it is online now, and you can find that documentary, information about it, on the website zeitgeistfilms.com, zeitgeistfilms.com. We've been speaking with J. Michael Lennon, Emeritus Professor of English at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, who is the authorized biographer of Norman Mailer. The study, Norman Mailer, A Double Life, was published by Simon & Schuster and is critically acclaimed. And today, on the 102nd anniversary of the birth of Norman Mailer, he was born in New Jersey on this day, January 31st in 1923, speaking with Dr. Lennon about a new book that wasn't meant to be published. It's titled Lipton's Mailer's Marijuana Journal, 1954-55. And Dr. Lennon co-edited the volume with J.R. Lucas and Susan Mailer, Norman Mailer's daughter. A very good place to check for information, all things Mailer, would be Dr. Lennon's own website, and that is jmichaellennon.com, jmichaellennon.com, and it's LENNON.com, and there will be two L's together, jmichaellennon.com. And we spoke today about Lipton's Mailer's Marijuana Journal, 1954 through 55, and about the documentary How to Come Alive with Norman Mailer by Jeff Zimbalist at zeitgeistfilms.com, zeitgeistfilms.com.